Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is writer and journalist Kathy O'Neill. She received her PhD in mathematics from Harvard University and has worked in finance, tech, and academia. And we're talking about her new book, The Shame Machine: Who Profits in the New Age of Humiliation? Kathy, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you, Mark. I'm glad to be here.
I want to say, for the benefit of the audience, there's so much in this book that we can't possibly do justice to it in a 30-minute interview. So we're only going to touch on a few of the subjects of this. It's, as you write in the introduction, it's hard to look at shame and harder to make sense of. And that seems like one of those things that should be obvious, but until you try to, I'm sure, write a book about it or analyze it or figure out what's going on, it's really true. I don't understand the function of shame. Talk about the Pueblo Clown Society, and I guess you should address that as an example of society dealing positively with shame.
Yeah, I mean, and just to be clear, it never feels good to be shamed. It never feels good. It's very, very tough to feel shame. And I'm not trying to suggest that in the Pueblo Clown Society they make it feel good. But I do think what they do is something that's, I consider, healthy shame, in the sense that it tries to fulfill the primary goal of shame, namely to get people to conform to some norm, to some rule that they've been breaking. And I'll say a little bit about the way they did do that. The Pueblo, the Hopi Pueblo, have like summer festivals where they have a lot of solemn rituals. But in between those solemn rituals, in these three-day summer festivals, they have sort of the entertainment. These are called the clowns. And they like appear at first, so they show up, you know, a lot over the 3 days. They appear at first as like aliens, like they're painted white, they land on the roof, they seem to not know the rules. So it's exactly like they don't know what it means to be Hopi. And they learn the rules. I mean, at first they really don't know the rules. They're like having sex in public, they're eating poop, they're doing all these things that are outrageous. And that's the point, that they are being taught the rules. And by the middle, they kind of know the rules. And near the end of the festival, they're actually sort of shaming people who haven't been following the rules. So the whole point, number one, is to sort of cohere the rules themselves, right? Like,
so those are the societal rules.
Yeah, like, we don't do this. We don't poop. We don't eat our poop. We don't have sex in public. We don't. And in particular, the one example I interviewed someone about who had witnessed this. Saw the Hopi sort of pull out and publicly shame a particular guy for bootlegging, which is to say, like, selling alcohol within the village, which was a real scourge for the Hopi. So, you know, the idea there is that they want people, now that they know the rules, they're, like, enforcing them. And the larger idea is that, you know, if you use shame correctly, you make the stragglers conform, and you don't kick them out of the society. You try to get them to be part of society more appropriately. So that's the idea of shame used in a healthy way.
And that's the opposite of what goes on a lot, especially through the internet, that there seems to be things where it's really easy for everybody to pile on to make fun of people. You gave an example of a woman, I think, who fell down in Walmart. I may be misremembering that. And everybody, you know, you pass the meme along and everybody makes their nasty comments. There's no sense of, first of all, healing from that. Sense of trying to get that person to be part of our society. It's just sort of piling on. It's like a different kind of shame. It's just shame for shame's purpose. There's no shaming for societal purpose. It's just shame for the glee of shaming.
Yeah, it's really important in the Hopi Clown Society example to remember that the bootlegger didn't get kicked out, right?
That's right.
Next summer, we don't want to be publicly shaming you. We want you to have like learn your lesson, you know? Whereas, the example of is part of People of Walmart, which is just a site dedicated to making fun of people in Walmart. And
the particular
example was like an obese woman who was in a wheelchair and who fell out of her wheelchair trying to reach something. And there's a
first of all, that's just really awful.
Awful, awful, just terrible. And in a rare example, it became so viral that people actually found her and interviewed her, and she was just like, "Yeah, people try to humiliate me all the time. I'm used to it. It's just so awful." But to your point, like, you know, there's no sense in which people are saying, "Hey, we'd like to help you become more integrated into society." You know, there's no pretense of like we all want this to work, you know, as a group, as a community. Which, you know, I just want to back up and just say, like, shame always happens with respect to some norm or rule, but it's not always obvious that that people can conform, you know, that even if they wanted to. Whereas with bootlegging, it is right.
You can stop bootlegging.
But you can't stop being fat. You can't stop being in a wheelchair or being disabled or being old. There's a bunch of things that we shame people for that they don't actually have a choice about.
Well, you know, this. The more I read your book, the more I realized, has the threshold for what we're shaming people about just dropped through the floor or something? Like, I have to believe that when I was a little kid, making fun of somebody who's in a wheelchair that fell out of a wheelchair, that would not be accepted. You would be shamed for making that comment. But it just seems like the bottom is totally dropped about what's appropriate in a society.
Yeah, and it's I think in large part because the norms of like the standards of like of the internet have really changed the way we think of our behavior. So you're right. Like if you were in person making fun of someone pointing and laughing, I don't even think the people who took the picture would have probably done that. They were probably raised.
They were just discreetly putting it on their phone, thinking that they're going to post it later.
Yeah.
And that's the evil part of it. That's the evil part of it. You don't have the guts to actually make the comment to the person's face.
That's a very good point. There is a cowardice about it.
Yeah.
Because it's bullying. At the end of the day, it's bullying, but it's not open bullying. It's sort of secret bullying. And, you know, at least if you're an open bully, then you have the chance to get punched in the face or
That's
something.
That's right. That's exactly you know? Right.
So there's like no recourse for people to you know, get upset with you if you're doing it secretly. And so I do think the internet has changed things, like, and the snark, of course, is through the roof, as we know. But it's certainly not, you know, I certainly don't want to suggest that the people who did that are doing a good job. But I just want to point out that, like, we are conditioned to do that as well, right? Like, the context of websites and social media platforms are that you should be doing this. You should be posting something that will gain a lot of attention.
This brings me to a very important point throughout your book. There are, and I think this is a quote from your book, there are entire industries that thrive on shame.
Yeah.
And you, every chapter of your book is sort of a different example, including there's a lot on fat shaming. The cosmetics industry thrives on the fact that you're embarrassed about how your hair looks, how your nose looks, how your skin looks. Medicine. You had a really interesting chapter about you dealing with surgery that you had, bariatric surgery, and how, in weird ways, the medical establishment was shaming into the way that you looked at yourself. It's like, as you write, shame and stigma enforce taboos. But in what way are they doing this? I mean, is everybody just supposed to look the same and act the same and not do anything different?
I'm not exactly sure. There's so many questions there, but I will agree that, and it goes back to my earlier comment about does the target of shame have a choice?
That's right.
That one of the big assumptions that we make in order to feel validated to shame someone is that that person had the choice and they made the wrong choice. So it's particularly the case with fatness, that the assumption is that if you're fat, you've been immoral. You know, you've been bad, and you've been making bad, poor choices that are somehow sinful. That's the sort of premise of The Biggest Loser, that these people.
Oh yeah.
A reality show around fat people losing weight quickly. The idea is that they should be sort of punished and publicly humiliated on an ongoing basis in order to sort of atone for their sinful behaviors in the past. And it's like, it's somehow very appreciated by the audience, who really wants to see punishment distributed. And of course, like, the sad fact is, number one, that diets on average do not work. Number two, that people get, in spite of that, go on diets constantly and spend billions of dollars doing so. And in particular, for the candidates of the contestants in The Biggest Loser, many of them gained the weight back, but many of them have gotten really quite sick from their experiences there.
One of the great things is that you're a mathematician, yeah. And so you bring that to the fore. In several areas of this, and the chapter on dieting and the dieting companies and the whole businesses that thrive on diets and the way they take statistics is really fascinating. And I didn't know that. So when they say that, you know, all these people are losing weight. Yeah. When most people start diets, they lose weight, but then in a year they start getting the weight back again. That's what happens most often.
Yeah, I wouldn't even say most people lose weight.
The
truth is, I'll just say that, you know, the high level thing, which is that for every shame machine industry, there is a whole fake science. There's a pseudoscience
surrounding
it that boosts it. And I'll go into the statistical buffoonery of weight loss first, but I just want to say that there is a version of this for every chapter, but the first thing is, and I'll just talk about my deep dive into Noom, which is like this app that claims not to even be a diet app, but of course it is, because all they really care about is losing weight.
And the TV ads are like the personal read, like, oh, and then they're gonna lose weight. That's what's happening.
Right, yeah. Right. Exactly. The undiet diet, you know, they don't want to be the old school and say, like, you need to lose weight. So rather, they're going to say, you're going to think differently and be mindful about eating or whatever it is. It's almost more insulting, to be honest, as a fat person. It's almost more fat shaming to pretend it's not a diet. But beyond the marketing, the way they argue that this is scientifically valid is that they cite a study. And this is just such a generic problem with studies that I'm going to talk about what they did in this terrible study, but I just want to point out that it's always the case that this happens. Namely, they only counted people that stayed on Zoom for a long, long time and were consistent about using it. And they never mentioned in the study how many people they have excluded when they do that. So imagine you download an app, and imagine you're like, okay, I want to lose some weight. I'm going to download this app, this mindfulness eating app. What are the chances you're going to still be using it 12 months later? What are the chances?
Right.
Very low. So if they only consider people who have been on it for 12 months, of course, those are the people that have had huge success, but it's self-selection. So to your point, when you said most people lose weight, but I'm just saying not most people. Some people
I
lose
sit
weight.
Corrected, Kathy.
Yeah. But even those people, and this is the terrible news, even those people who do stay on for 12 months eventually gain the weight back on average. And so it's like, it's bad news for that small group of people for whom it's good news, right? So it's terrible, and it's not their fault. Like, just to be clear, we just don't know. We don't, as a scientific community, we just don't know why people are gaining weight. We don't know why people are so fat. It is an actual mystery, but we don't like mysteries. We like certainty. We like to blame people for having problems. We like to shift the blame of big society problems like poverty, like addiction, and like fatness. We like to shift the blame onto the people who suffer from the problem and say, your fault, go fix it. And that is a sort of the crux of most of the shame industry, is that we don't want to deal with these problems, even though we don't know, like, we actually don't know how to. And so we're like, instead of figuring out how to do this, we're going to blame the victims.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is writer and journalist Kathy O'Neill. She received her PhD in mathematics from Harvard University. She's worked in finance, tech, and academia. And we're talking about her new book, which I strongly recommend that you read, The Shame Machine: Who Profits in the New Age of Humiliation? One of the terms you use, Kathy, throughout the book is punching up and punching down. And that when you feature that photograph, that film of the poor woman in Walmart, you're punching down. So give me an example of punching up. And you mentioned things like poverty and addiction. Yeah, it's really easy to blame the poor people. They're not hardworking enough. They don't really care about getting a job. But you're not really doing anything with the people who could actually fix the problem.
Right. Yes. Right. So punching down is defined as shaming somebody who either does not have the choice to conform to the rule that you're talking about, or does not have the voice to defend themselves or to be seen doing better. And so basically everyone on the internet, like, that you're like shaming, but you'll never see again.
Yep.
That's denying them voice. You can think of it as a kind of due process. They have no chance to defend themselves. They can't apologize. They can't do better. They can't be redeemed. That's punching down. Punching up is the opposite. Punching up is you're shaming somebody who has a choice and has a voice. So they could be doing better and they could defend themselves. And so I think the classic target for punching up is holding power to account. You know, so if you want to hold power to account, you punch up, you shame up, you say, hey, people, politicians, you know, you ran on this ideal and you're not living up to that ideal now that you're in office. Shame on you. And that's punching up, right? And the idea is, like, you're asking the people who have the power, and it's often punching up is often up, you know, a power dynamic where you're like, It requires organizing. You're asking people with power to do the right thing.
It also takes time, Kathy. It's not one of the things. It's really easy to punch down. That takes a second and a click on your computer. But punching up actually requires you get organized. You may have to join a movement. You have a great example in the book of Nigeria, the government of Nigeria, who was just sort of a kleptocracy of shaming money, and people, the citizens, actually started to post film of the people who were raking them down, and it had an effect.
It did, although, you know, and it's called End SARS movement, and it became an international movement, and it's still ongoing, and of course you have to make sure that either the people that you're targeting directly feel shame, you know, or feel like pressure to do the right thing, or that there's somebody that they care about that feels shame. So, like, if you think about, like, Putin and Zelensky, for example, right now, Zelensky, by the way, is like a absolute professional punch upper. So he constantly shames the powers in the West, right? The leaders to help him defend his people against Putin. And to, like, walk the walk as well as talk the talk about, you know, the Western democracy and stuff like that. Whereas Putin, you know, is shameless, if you will, like, he's sociopathic, so he doesn't actually feel shame. There's no sense in shaming him, but there is sense in shaming the people that support him. And that's what has been happening to some effect. And that's, you know, so you see this happening in sort of geopolitics all the time. And I will add that, like, sometimes punching up shame is literally the only tool you have. If you are thinking along the lines of the apartheid movement in South Africa,
right.
You know, the actual laws are unjust, the actual laws. So you can't appeal to a judge in a court, or a Supreme Court for that matter. You have to appeal to international attempts of shaming people in power, and that actually ultimately worked. One last thing about punching up: it's not profitable. You know,
right.
you pointed out that punching down is easier. Well, it's also more profitable.
And it's profitable for the platforms online.
Yeah.
That love you to shame. And that's people like Facebook and so on and so forth. They profit from shame. They love when there's controversy. And then people start throwing all sorts of memes back and forth at each other. And they're profiting from that.
I totally agree. And I think it's really kind of subtle what they've done. I mean, not so subtle if you...
And it's not subtle at all.
No, not exactly subtle. What I mean is, you know, if you think about the cosmetics industry, the weight loss industry, a lot of those shame machines, those profitable shame machines, they directly shame the customer. They say, you know, shame on you for being old, buy our skin cream. Shame on you for being old, like, buy Prevagen, which is a fake
medicine
that will make you smart.
Don't go into that, but I want to say to people, I didn't know anything about that company until I read your book.
Yeah,
Now I do.
A great example of a pseudoscience in order to shame people. But my point is that those are sort of classic shame industry complex industries in the sense that they directly shame customers to make them buy their product. Whereas the social media platforms, they don't directly shame us. What they do instead is they create the perfect atmosphere and environment for us to shame each other.
Right.
So it is a very important difference because number one, we are very good at shaming each other. And number two, we get conditioned over time. This is my premise that we get conditioned to shame each other. And we have just become sort of addicted to that shame outrage spiral that happens incessantly on social media.
It also seems, Kathy, that not only do we shame each other, but then everybody just piles on.
Yeah.
So there's this thing where it snowballs to like sort of an alarming, and there's no forgiveness at the end of it, or no coming to terms with it, or trying to make it better. There's a good example, and my initial reaction to this, because I'm a bird watcher, the story of the blackbirder in Central Park, I think his name was Christian Cooper.
Yeah.
And that woman who just called the police on him.
Amy
Cooper, no relation.
Yep.
And I remember when I first saw that, I was outraged and I piled on her. And even Christian Cooper said after a certain point, you know, it's time to stop that. You know, I mean, he had a better grip on it than everybody else around.
I thought he was a really interesting, smart, and thoughtful man. I agree with you that he saw that quite rightly, that it's a little too easy just to sort of shame her. Because it's punching down, first of all. From my perspective, it is like, well, we're never going to listen to her apologize or defend herself, or she's not going to, you know, remain in our sights to atone and to be redeemed. But more importantly, it's an opportunity, and this is kind of the point of my book, if you will. It's an opportunity to, instead of punching down at her, to punch up. Like,
right.
To ask the important question of, like,
why did she feel that way?
Error.
Yeah.
There's a systemic problem here that a white woman can do that. They can sort of confidently call the cops thinking my ridiculous complaint and unfounded against an innocent black man will no doubt be taken seriously and he will be punished. Like, that's the problem. I mean, if the cops responded by saying, lady, what are you doing? You're wasting our time.
Right.
Consistently, then there wouldn't be any Karens. You know, there wouldn't be any women calling, white women calling the cops on black people. It's because the police are sort of designed and trained to respond to white women's fears. That's the problem that we have to address as a country.
Well, you point out throughout the book, there is a racial aspect to a lot of shaming too. And that is especially true when it comes to things like poverty and addiction. There is definitely a racial aspect to the shaming.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, listen, it is rather involved, but I want to point out that we are working in this country with a lot of white shame. Like we are, you know, the white people, such as myself, and others, we're sort of not working. We haven't worked through our racial shame, our shame around slavery, around, you know, right. Jim Crow. Like, and these are, of course, this is very related to the fact that we haven't done the reckoning that we need to do. So I think of shame as having sort of four phases, and I'll just say that the second phase, which is where we're stuck, is the denial and what's called cognitive dissonance, where we just sort of say, wait, we are good people. We can't be shameful. We can't be unlovable and unworthy. So there must be a problem here. Let's just deny that we did anything wrong. And that denial is a problem, obviously. But it's our problem to fix. We have to go through the reckoning of figuring out what we've actually done, and very few people have actually done that, although it's not zero. It needs to happen on a larger scale. But in the meantime, because we are ashamed, the problem with shame is that when people get stuck in that second phase of denial, they often act very, very badly. And that's what we're doing. Like, that's what racism is.
Well, it's defending your idea of who you think you are.
Yeah.
Not taking into account of how you fit into society and how other people think about you, both as an individual and as a culture and the history of the stuff. I mean, this is like the banning of Black history that's going on right now in grade school, which makes my mind explode. But that's all about that.
It's hard to interrupt you, but I just can't believe how consistent it is with my thinking about it. They actually said they don't want the law. I think in Florida was like, you don't want to make white children feel
bad. Oh my God, Kathy, we got to stop there because we're out. We have to. Yeah. Oh God, don't get me started. We're completely out of time. My guest tonight has been writer and journalist Kathy O'Neill. She received a PhD in mathematics from Harvard and uses it well in this book, by the way, and has worked in finance, tech, and academia. We're talking about her new book. I strongly recommend it. The Shame Machine: Who Profits in the New Age of Humiliation? Kathy, it's been a real pleasure.
Mark, it's been such a great time talking to you. Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.